Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 9th of May, these are our main stories. Sudan's former foreign minister says the mistrust between the two warring factions is so deep that she doubts a proper ceasefire is possible. Closing arguments have been heard in the civil trial in which the former US President Donald Trump is accused of raping and later defaming a writer. Officials in Nepal say three people are missing after an avalanche hit a group collecting a fungus known as the Himalayan Viagra. Also in this podcast. The pioneering African-American opera star Grace Bunbury has died at the age of 86. The former foreign minister of Sudan, Mariam al-Sadiq al-Mahdi, has told the BBC she doubts the rival military factions can agree on a genuine ceasefire due to deep mistrust. Representatives of the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces are currently meeting in Saudi Arabia, as we reported in our earlier edition. The former foreign minister, Dr. al-Sadiq al-Mahdi, has said officials loyal to the former president, Omar al-Bashir, were trying to ensure the army's fight against the paramilitary rapid support forces continued.
They declared more than, I think, 8 or 10 ceasefire. They never hold because it is something, I see it very complicated, because the Sudanese armed forces are putting a condition for rapid support force to get out of the safe haven they are having inside the densely populated neighborhoods and from also strategic buildings. It would be impossible for rapid support force to get out of them because it's their protection. And to get out with any assurances from SAF, it requires some basic level of trust. There is absolutely no any trust between the two. And actually, there is like personal vendetta and personal hatred between the two leaders.
Millions of residents of the Sudanese capital Khartoum are facing increasing hardship and dwindling supplies of essential foods. Phone and internet companies have also been shutting down their services because of a lack of fuel. To add to their hardship, an epidemic of looting is adding to chaos and causing shortages of basic supplies. Hospitals, banks, factories, shops and homes are being emptied by looters. And eyewitnesses say much of the theft is part of an organised campaign by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Hala al-Karib is an activist in Sudan. She's part of a movement which has long been pushing for democracy in the country. My colleague Paul Henley got through to her to ask what she's seen of the looting. She spoke to him from a place just south of the capital, Khartoum.
It's just unimaginable how the country has been looted. It's shocking. You know, for example, there is a research center in northern Khartoum. You know, it's an industrial research center. And there is research papers, there is computers, there is desks. And this place was looted and burned. You know, so it's not only looting, but it's also damaging infrastructures. Half of my friends and my family homes were looted. Their homes were looted right in front of their eyes. Everything was taken from them while they were just staring at the RSF, you know, taking everything. You know, I have a friend of mine, she lived in an apartment building. The whole apartment building, they have about 16 apartments. They were asked to leave, just leave. You know, the RSF occupied the apartment and they looted and took everything. So it's looting, it's forced eviction, it's occupations of other people's property. I'm traveling south of Khartoum and I have seen how the factories were looted. You know, the RSF would open, you know, the factories and they will loot what they can and then they will invite other people to loot. Similarly, a similar situation happened in Omdurman where they looted the Bank of Khartoum and then they were chanting and inviting other people to come and loot as well and take what they can from the bank. There was a lot of money, and they broke the safes, they broke everything, and everything was open.
You mentioned people, you're talking about individuals, opportunists, but you also mentioned the RSF, the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, one of the two warring parties. Are you saying this is specifically organised by them, encouraged?
Yes, they are. This has been happening in Darfur for the past 20 years. The destruction of the infrastructure, you know, destructions of schools, of local governments, buildings, you know, of clinics. This has been carried on, you know, intentionally and methodically for the past 20 years in Darfur. So it's a strategy, you know, to create chaos.
It's working. It's doing that, isn't it?
Yes.
How does it feel to be in the middle of that?
It's extremely painful to be in the middle. It's puzzling. It's confusing. It's paralyzing, especially when the other party is equally problematic, which is something should have been addressed long time ago. The need for fundamental reform of the security sector in Sudan. Unfortunately, we are paying the price. Everyone has been ignoring the elephant in the room.
All this must make you ask yourself, what future have I got here? Are you planning to stay?
You know, I have my life here. I have people that I love here. I have people that they never imagine themselves dying somewhere else. So far, I just feel that I have an obligation to stay with them. And it doesn't seem right to just back up and leave. Majority of Sudanese, by the way, are still in Sudan. You know, there is only a few thousand. How many? 50,000, 70,000 who are able to leave. We are very poor people. Majority of us cannot afford leaving this country.
Hala Al-Karib speaking to Paul Henley. Air support is seen to be crucial for Ukraine's long-awaited counteroffensive. But Russia's air dominance means that Ukrainian planes are limited in what they can do near the front line. To boost its air power, Ukraine wants its Western partners to send modern jets like F-16s. But what difference will they make? And can they change the tide of this war? The BBC's Abduljalil Abdurasulov has spoken to Ukrainian pilots to hear about their side of the air war.
A Su-25 Ukrainian attack jet is on a combat mission near the front line in eastern Ukraine. Its pilot, with a call sign Pumba, fires two rockets at ground targets and immediately banks away at a nearly 90-degree angle. He dives the jet so low that he can see the treetops, trying to evade a Russian missile attack. During such missions, Pumba is always accompanied by a MiG-29 fighter jet. Its job is to provide cover from Russian missiles.
We are forced to deny a lot of missions, a lot of sorties due to the Russian air defense, due to the Russian fighter jets, first of all fighter jets.
A MiG-29 pilot with the call sign Juice explains what Russian dominance in the air means for them.
They know when we are flying to the front lines, and they're trying to find us, to lock us, and to shoot their missiles at us.
The range of Russian missiles can be up to four times larger than the ones on Ukrainian jets. And thanks to their powerful radars, Russian jets can shoot down Ukrainian planes long before they pose any threat to them or to Russian ground forces. Pilot Juice again.
Now we don't have any response to them. We can't shoot them at all.
That is why Ukraine is pushing its Western partners to give them more modern jets, such as US-made F-16s. Air support is seen to be crucial for the success of the expected Ukrainian counteroffensive. Colonel Volodymyr Logachev is the head of the Aviation Development Department of the Ukrainian Air Forces.
Our planes always fly inside the zone of Russian air defense and within the range of Russian jets missiles. So we keep losing our aircraft. F-16 will allow us to operate outside of their missiles range, to expand our area of operation and reduce the possibilities of being shot down.
But the U.S. has ruled out sending F-16s to Ukraine for now. even training Ukrainian pilots has not been approved. It is clear that F-16s are unlikely to be delivered this year. That is why Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has already announced that the expected counteroffensive will go ahead without these Western jets. Some experts doubt that F-16s are worth all the effort and resources.
Western fighters ultimately would be about providing another layer of defense. It wouldn't be to turn the war around on its own.
Professor Justin Bronk, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Service Institute, argues that the ground infrastructure, including short and rough runways, are not fit for F-16s.
It's not that you couldn't adapt them and resurface them, clean them, maybe extend them, but it's that doing that will be visible to the Russians from space and also through human intelligence sources. And so if you only do one or two bases and then try and set up the ground support apparatus to operate something like F-16 or F-15, then the Russians will see it and the Russians will strike it. So you would have to do lots of them. And then you're into the question of, is that worth the number of skilled personnel and the amount of effort and political effort and logistical support that could otherwise be used for other things like tanks and artillery and ground-based air defense systems and all of that?
For now, Ukrainian pilots will have to rely on their old Soviet-era fighters and attack jets. Some of them have flown more than 100 combat missions. But they know that each flight could be their last.
Let's head to the Serbian capital, Belgrade, now, because tens of thousands of people have joined a protest there after two mass shootings in the country last week. 17 people were killed in those attacks, including 8 children. Guy Delaunay has the details.
Serbian teachers have been marching through Belgrade, calling for the authorities to increase safety at educational institutions. They're asking for stricter penalties for assaults on teachers and the suspension of disruptive or violent students. Opposition parties are taking a different stance in their countrywide protests. They say media outlets connected to the governing Progressive Party have been encouraging violence through sensationalist programming and disinformation. But there are also concerns that the government may use the tragedies to introduce repressive legislation.
Guy Delaunay. The closing arguments in Donald Trump's civil trial in New York have been taking place. E. Jean Carroll, a writer, alleges the former US president raped her in a department store in Manhattan in the mid-1990s and then defamed her by denying it had happened. Our correspondent Neda Torfik is in New York and told me what was said in court.
We heard first, of course, from E. Jean Carroll's lawyer, Roberta Kaplan, and essentially her lawyer said, look, E. Jean Carroll has been credible, consistent, and brave on the stand. Her testimony was backed by 11 witnesses. So it is essentially their word versus Trump, who she pointed out never showed up to court. And she said that Donald Trump had, in his own words, in his infamous Access Hollywood tape, admitted that his modus operandi was to grab women because he was a star and could. She played that tape in court, and then she played a deposition of his reacting to that, saying that had been true of stars for millions of years, fortunately or unfortunately. So she tried to tell the jury that Donald Trump had said this in his own words, that others had backed up E. Jean Carroll's account, and that in order to side with Donald Trump, the jury would essentially have to believe a big lie, that there was a coordinated conspiracy by the writer and two of her friends who she told about the attack to somehow pin all of this on Donald Trump because they didn't like him. And then we heard a rebuttal from the defense, Joe Tacopina, Donald Trump's lawyer, basically saying that all of this was a work of fiction, that these witnesses had been put up as a distraction, and that the jury had to find in favor of Donald Trump because otherwise the justice system would turn into a tyranny.
Now, I suppose we should remind our listeners this is just one of several legal challenges facing Mr. Trump as he seeks a return to the White House, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. I mean, he has denied this case. He has in other cases when it comes to investigations, for example, into efforts to overturn the election or even cases that are now underway in New York in regards to his business. Of course, the criminal case is the biggest one here in New York. He's all said these are all witch hunts and politically motivated.
Neda Torfik. A full run-through of Tuesday night's semi-final of the Eurovision Song Contest has been taking place in the British city of Liverpool. 30 countries will be taking part, with Ukraine, who won last year, automatically qualifying for the grand final. They'll be joined by the UK, France, Germany, Italy and Spain, who each get a free pass because of their financial contributions to the event. 160 million people are expected to tune in worldwide. Our Eurovision reporter Daniel Rosny is there.
Outside of sport, there is no bigger audience. This is the 67th Song Contest and it is still relevant. It is still able to launch global superstars. Måneskin, who won for Italy in 2021, they have become huge stars all over the world. They're playing Glastonbury Festival in June. They were nominated for a Grammy this year for Best New Artist. Of course, it has launched careers for Celine Dion, ABBA, Olivia Newton-John in the past, but it is still able, all these years later, to break artists around the world.
Daniel Rosny. Still to come on this podcast, Afghan refugees in Turkey rebuild their lives after this year's devastating earthquake.
I am excited. There is hope and we are hopeful. We will rebuild. This too will pass and everybody will settle back to their lives and achieve their goals.
Fifteen years ago, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martine Vik Magnussen was killed in an apartment near Mayfair.
23-year-old Martine Vik Magnussen was found partially buried in the basement.
Before being questioned, the only suspect in the case had fled the UK to Yemen. I made a promise to Martina's family to find out what happened. Murder in Mayfair, part of the documentary. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
It's known as Himalayan Viagra for its supposed aphrodisiac qualities. Being a Yasa Gumbha collector, to give it its proper name, is very lucrative, but it's also a dangerous job. It's a fungus that rather gruesomely grows out of the head of caterpillars that live high up in the Himalayan meadows. And now officials in Nepal say three people are missing after an avalanche hit a group of collectors. Our South Asia regional editor, Ambrasan Etarajan, told me more.
The communities in the Himalayan region, especially in Nepal and also across the border in Tibet, this is one of the major ways of earning revenue for them. So this particular insect where the fungus grows on, the stage it reaches is available only for a few weeks. So there is a mad rush for people to go and collect this. So those villagers who go there, first of all, they face the altitude sickness, number one. Two, if the weather turns bad, then if there's a snow, then that triggers avalanche. And many people, they get washed away by streams, fast-running streams, because this is a 2 to 3 week process. You need to go and camp there and go from place to place. You know, people get sick. In case if you fall sick, then again, you don't have any access to medical facilities nearby. So there are innumerable number of hardships faced by these people. In addition to that, some villagers feel that it is a curse for them because it also brings about rivalry between various groups.
And it is incredibly expensive. $18,000 a kilogram. I've read figures of that nature. And so people, as you said, they're willing to go out of their way to do this. Is it actually legal to collect it?
Until 2001, Nepal had banned this practice, but then they had started giving permits. And if you are from that particular region, then you get a very low amount of fees, something like $3-4. Whereas if you're coming from the other districts, then you have to pay more. Nowadays, the government issues permits so that they can keep track of the number of people who are going to gather Gasamba, or you call this Himalayan Viagra. But there are villagers from other villages, those who don't go through the main towns, they may even go illegally to go and collect them.
And Ambrosan, it's highly prized because it's supposed to be an aphrodisiac. Is there any scientific evidence to back that up?
Many of these beliefs in Oriental medicine, like animal parts, it's all based on beliefs. And according to their own local traditional knowledge and custom. So Yasa Gumbha is also used in soups, as in tea. Many people believe that it can cure various ailments ranging from headache to even cancer. But one of the main things people buy is because it is treated as an aphrodisiac. But So far, there has been no medical evidence to suggest that it is going to increase your virility or cure some disease.
That was Ambrosan Etirajan. On Sunday, Turkey will hold its presidential election. The rebuilding of destroyed cities in earthquake-struck regions is one of the main issues facing voters. At least 2 million people in southeastern Turkey lost their homes in the earthquake in February, and they include a small community of Afghans who had sought refuge in a remote village, which is sometimes called Little Afghanistan. The BBC's Firuz Rahimi visited the village, Overkent, where the people have come together to rebuild their lives in their only sanctuary.
In a remote village in outskirts of Hatay province in southern Turkey, a secluded cemetery has become a place of sanctuary for Nihal. She comes here every day to visit graves of her daughter and two of her grandchildren. 3 months on, she can't stop her tears when she remembers her loved ones.
We were hit by the earthquake. Everything raised to the ground. My daughter and two of my grandchildren died. We are shattered.
Nihal and her family arrived here in Turkey 42 years ago after they were forced to leave Afghanistan. But a peaceful life they built over decades turned upside down in a little over a minute.
She was very close to me. The pain will stay with me forever. I can't get over the death of my daughter until I die.
Known as Little Afghanistan, this little village has become a safe haven for thousands of refugees. Walking down the only marketplace of the village reminded me of a district in northern Afghanistan where people is speaking in Uzbek language. A few blocks away from the main market, 41-year-old Zahra took me to what is left of her house. This is where she and her husband moved with their 7 children when they first came from Afghanistan 3 years ago. On the night when the earthquake struck, her husband went back to the house to rescue their disabled child. He saved a son, but lost his own life. He was the only breadwinner of the family. Zahra is left with 7 children to feed and an uncertain future.
My biggest worry is that my kids are very young. None of them are old. My eldest son is disabled and he can't walk. He needs one person to take care of him.
That night, the devastating earthquake killed at least 147 people in Overkent. The survivors are now moved into nearby tents and temporary accommodation. A communal kitchen provided the locals with the food.
Right now, I am right in the centre of Overkent village. It is the hub of activity, and this place has brought the community more closer to each other. In here there's like about 10 men. Some of them are dressed in traditional Afghan clothes and some of them in normal clothing, young and old, and everybody's doing something. This place used to bring the community together before earthquake, and there's like around 10 massive pots where the food used to be cooked.
While the community holds together, the destroyed buildings in the Little Afghanistan is being demolished. The quiet village has turned into a playground for heavy trucks and bulldozers clearing the rubble.
It is hard for people to leave the buildings behind they used to call home. They look at the devastation around them, unable to imagine the future. But there are already signs that this community is rebuilding.
And everyone in this community is coming together to take part to rebuild their lives. One of them is Islam, who is a local businessman. I am meeting him in an empty plot of land where his 3-story textile and sewing factory once stood high. Now, nothing left. You can hardly imagine, a few months ago, more than 60 people worked here. He salvaged whatever he could from the remains of his business to restart his work from a little garage with only 2 workers.
I am excited. There is hope and we are hopeful. We will rebuild. This too will pass and everybody will settle back to their lives and achieve their goals.
And it is steps like these that give hope to the community as the survivors cling on what is left. They want to see their little Afghanistan rise again from the rubbles.
That was Firuz Rahimi. The singer Grace Bunbury, one of the first African-Americans to become a star of international opera, has died in Vienna. She was 86. Born in Missouri, she won a scholarship to the St. Louis Institute of Music, but was denied entry because of her skin colour. Instead, Grace Bunbury launched her career in Europe, making her debut at the Paris Opera. In 1961, she became the first black person to perform in a major role at the Bayreuth Festival in Germany. Judy Frankel looks back at her life.
Grace Bunbury was born in St. Louis, Missouri in 1937. Her father was a railroad porter, her mother a schoolteacher, but music played a central part in family and church life, and when she was just 17 years old, she won a local radio talent show, singing one of Verdi's great arias.
I did O Don Fatale from Don Carlos. Oh, that's my war horse. Whenever I auditioned for anything, I used O Don Fatale, and it always worked.
Her success got her a scholarship to study music, and in 1960 she made her operatic debut in Paris. After several years as a mezzo-soprano, unusually for a singer, she switched to being a soprano, adding more roles to her repertoire.
I always said that I don't want to be put into a box. I want to do that which fits my voice. My Lord done, done just
what he said, yes. In 2009, President Obama presented her with a Kennedy Center honor for her contribution to the performing arts.
Judy Frankel on the life of Grace Bunbury, who's died. In Britain, 2 days after the coronation, the Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines has become the latest leader of a Caribbean country to call for the King's removal as its head of state. Dr. Ralph Gonsalves called the current position an absurdity that had prevented the islands fully reclaiming their independence. As we reported in our earlier edition, the Prime Minister of St. Kitts and Nevis has warned that his country is not totally free under the monarchy. Buckingham Palace says the decision to become a republic is a matter for individual countries. With these latest calls from the Caribbean for the removal of the last formal vestiges of the British Empire from their countries, our diplomatic correspondent James Landale has been looking at what this might mean for them, the Commonwealth and the King.
Most of Britain's former colonies became republics the moment they won their independence. But many Caribbean countries decided instead to keep the stability of a British monarch as their head of state. And almost ever since, there's been speculation about them changing their minds. The coronation has prompted fresh debate in Jamaica, Belize and now the West Indies. The Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines has form on this. Comrade Ralph, as he's known in the islands, campaigned for a republic in a referendum in 2009 and lost. In fact, only one Caribbean country, Barbados, has actually taken the plunge. It became a republic 2 years ago. The surprise is not that some realms want to become republics. It is that they have stuck with the crown for so long. Buckingham Palace has long recognised that over time, more will probably become republics. Of much more concern to courtiers is the need to protect the King's entirely separate relationship with the broader Commonwealth, which he now heads. Not for nothing was the organisation's Secretary-General, Lady Scotland, sitting next to the King at last night's concert.
James Landale. A joke sign for a fictional airport in mid-Wales has made a comeback just months after it was taken down because of its costly upkeep. The billboard from Llandegli International was first erected more than 20 years ago and became an amusing sight for motorists making their way through the hills of rural Wales. But now fans of the parody have got it back on the road, as Sue Charles reports.
It started out as a joke and ended up being a mid-Wales landmark. In 2002, a sign appeared for a fictional airport, Llandegli International, on a main road in a very rural part of the country. The man behind it, Nicholas Whitehead, used to write comedy sketches for a well-known BBC radio programme and worked with the famous British comedy group Monty Python. He wanted to do something completely different himself and came up with this idea for rural Radnorshire, where there's barely even a dual carriageway, let alone demand for an international airport. The sign was treated as an advertising billboard and cost around £1,500 per year to maintain. After spending £25,000 over 20 years, Mr. Whitehead decided to stop funding it. But it proved so popular, a crowdfund campaign was launched to save it.
I thought in a time of austerity, no local authority will want to pay for this themselves. So I thought we'll solve that problem for them and raise all the money. In the end, we only needed £1,300 and we raised £2,000 on a crowdfunder.
Now the sign's been put back up on farmland near the village where it can stay permanently. The airport's taken off on social media with thousands of followers enjoying updates about Llandegli's impressive environmental credentials. With a new sign in place and a growing fan club, Llandegli International is on the road again, but not open for business.
Sue Charles. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley, mixed by Chris Gonzalez. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, bye-bye.
In 2008, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martine Vik Magnussen went missing after a night out with friends in London.
I wonder what on earth could have happened.
We were so obsessed with just finding her.
Then,
police investigating the murder of a Norwegian socialite in central London.
Hours after her death, the only suspect in the case fled the UK to Yemen. His name is Farouk Abdelhak. He's never been questioned by the police. Nobody's been able to speak to him. Until now.
Got me, like, feeling a little bit sick to my stomach. I've never been open.
I'm Noelle El-Mekhafi, and I've been following this story since Martina was killed, making a promise to Martina's family to find out what happened. Murder in Mayfair. You can listen to the whole story now. Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.